It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. In 1976, the most famous Soviet dissident in the world moved to a tiny town in rural Vermont. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Nobel laureate, after years of prison, interrogation, labor camps, internal exile, KGB raids, took his wife and young sons and settled in Cavendish, Vermont. Population 1,264-ish. For the people of Cavendish, hiding the world's most famous dissident was a big responsibility.
Every town needs to have a secret that unites them in that secret. And for our town, it was Solzhenitsyn and not giving directions to his home.
Margot Caulfield runs the Cavendish Historical Society.
He moved here in 1976 and he left in 1994. He lived 18 of the 20 years he was in exile here. Literally bought the house sight unseen. It is an absolutely perfect location, and I often think what a gift the people of Cavendish gave him, because he was able to write. Everybody left him alone, and everybody protected his privacy. You know, the kids loved, if somebody would stop and say, how do we get to Solzhenitsyn's? You're going to be three towns over before you realize the kids were having you on. But that's really how the town felt. I mean, the KGB was here. There's no joke about that. They were dressed in a way that no Vermonter would dress, you know, much nicer looking in the dead of winter. You know you're not from Cavendish. Interestingly, the woman that ran the post office at the time, her family was from a part of Poland, and she said, some days we were Russian, some days we were Polish. So she spoke Russian, but she could tell. So people would come into the post office and they would speak Russian and not realizing that she could understand them. I've heard from a number of people. And then there was that time, remember, when the Russian government was sending people around, sort of in a glasnost type of thing. They were trying to go around to schools and speak about Russia and so forth. And they happened to pick Green Mountain Union High School, and two of the Solzhenitsyn kids were there who basically stood up and spoke to them in Russian. As we proverbially say, ripped them a new one.
Eventually, the Soviet Union collapsed, and Solzhenitsyn returned to Russia. But the house in Cavendish is still there. It still belongs to his family, and to this day, no one in town will tell you where it is.
You know, Vermonters are an interesting breed. You know, you do what you need to do, and as long as you pay your taxes and don't cause a normal amount of behavior, they just leave you be.
Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, our subject is, surprise, not Russian defectors or New England's small towns. It's resilience. The kind of resilience that lets people survive and even thrive in the face of hardship and sweeping life changes. We're going through a lot of that right now. And here's the good news. You were born with one of the most resilient brains on the planet. Biologically engineered to respond and adapt to everything life throws at you. And we know that thanks to something else that happened in Cavendish, a freak accident that changed the history of brain science and the life of a young man. His name was Phineas Gage.
Can I just take a picture?
Sure.
As Steve and I are poking around the museum Margot Caulfield runs, it's a former church turned into a repository of Victorian china and silverware, wooden school desks, mysterious farm implements.
This poster was found, and we blew it up so people can really read it. On the 13th of September, 1848, Mr. Gates was engaged in blasting a rock in Cavendish, Vermont, on the line of the Rutland and Burlington Railroad when a premature explosion took place, which forced an iron bar, I like that, completely through his head.
But just to put this in perspective, the rod that went through his head was, 3.5 feet long and nearly 2 inches in diameter, or 1.5 inches in diameter. I mean, we're talking a very big rod that shot straight through his head.
Right.
What's this?
This is a replica of the tamping rod. The real tamping rod would have been longer. So which end do you think went in first?
I would assume the pointed end, but you're going to tell me not, right?
No, it was the pointed end. If it had been the other way, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We would not be having this conversation.
News of the accident traveled all over the world. Phineas Gage became famous as the man who survived having his skull run through with an iron tamping rod.
You're all lucky.
It's not just that Phineas Gage survived the accident that nearly killed him. His case led doctors for the first time to link psychology, behavior, personality to specific areas in the brain. This small town in Vermont is basically where neuroscience was born.
So that's the boarding house where he lived, right?
Wait, which
there.
One is? Right there.
The rundown incredibly one. Beat up, rundown one with the porches entirely full of trash.
Yes.
Wow.
And you're going to come to an underpass. Keep on going around.
Keep on going.
Cavendish has seen better days. But in 1848, things were looking good. Gold was discovered in California. The first women's rights convention was held in Seneca Falls. Democratic revolutions were happening all over Europe. And even more important,
if you look to the right, you'll see some train tracks kind of covered in the woods, but there they are.
The railroad was coming to town.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Encourage anybody to walk on the train tracks, because this is a working rail line.
Oh, it's still used.
Oh, yeah. It was a really big deal what was going on here, and people would have really noticed it and been, bring on that railroad.
And they definitely would have noticed the attractive young construction foreman.
Phineas was 25 years of age. He was in excellent health. He was considered to be of medium build for his town. He was extremely well-liked by his employees as well as his employer.
On September 13th, Phineas and his crew were working south of the village, right about here.
And if you look down, you'll see the outcropping out there, which is where they would have been blasting. So what they would do is they would come out here, and as you see, there are these outcrops here, these big rocks that they had to get out of the way to make it possible for the train to get through these big cuts. So they would bore a hole, they would put the powder in, and they put it in as deeply as they could, lay a fuse in, fill it full of sand, and the sand is to really tap it in there, because you want that really deep in there, because when it would explode, it would give you the best bang for the buck. Big, you want it so it really cleared a lot of gravel rock out of the way. And either he was completely distracted or the assistant wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing, but basically the sand didn't get put in. He turned his head, maybe he was talking, and so as soon as that tamping rod, that metal, hit the gunpowder boom, that caused the explosion, and it went under his left cheek and right out of the top of the head. He was thrown back on the gun, and he kind of convulsed a few times, and then he sat up.
Wait, he sat up?
He sat up maybe a minute or so. He kind of sat up, and he was kind of amazed. the tamping rod was covered with gray matter and blood, and, you know, it's kind of a mess.
With his brain, is what you're saying.
Yes. Some of his workers tried to clean it off. Today we'd be like, don't touch that. That's forensic evidence. And they put him on an ox cart. And they followed the same path that we followed coming out here. They took him back into his hotel room.
Wasn't he in excruciating pain?
He would have definitely been in pain, but the worst part was he was throwing up. And every time he would throw up, brain matter is...
would come out of the top of his head, out of the hole in his head.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know, this is pretty graphic. Sorry. But hold on, because Dr. Harlow is on the way.
When Harlow gets there, Harlow...
Wait, explain who Harlow is. Who gets there?
Dr. Harlow, who really is the really amazing treating physician that takes care of him throughout all this and documents it, and it's why we know this case today. By the time he gets there at 6 p.m., I don't know how graphic we want to get here.
Oh, go for it.
Go for it. So he not only had a opening at the top, you've got this weeping coming from the other end, and basically Harlow sort of followed the trajectory by taking one finger going up and one finger going down till they met in the middle.
Wait, he could put his fingers through his head and touch his finger? Good God.
Yeah. You know, how many times, we don't know how many times Harlow was like, do you feel this? Do you feel that? You know, I hate to even have it. But
I'm just thinking, no sterile gloves either.
At least Harlow, he actually in his training practiced what was called aseptic technique, where you actually washed your hands somewhat. But Gage was very sick. It wasn't long, for fortunately he lapsed into a coma. His family was called, they came down, they built the coffin. The family had made up their mind. They had his clothes picked out, the coffin made. They were good to go. And they weren't really thrilled that Harlow was going to go ahead and say, no, I can handle this, which Harlow did.
It was a long and gruesome recovery. I'll spare you the details. But Gage did eventually heal. He lost one eye, and he had a permanent hole in his skull, covered by a thin layer of skin. He was a medical marvel. But he wasn't the same.
And this is when Harlow really begins to document the changes in him.
Before the accident, Phineas was a favorite with the railroad company. Now they reported he was fitful, volatile, disrespectful. He indulged, their words, in the grossest profanity.
People with the type of injury he had will often have rage, and I'm sure he was difficult.
Even his friends said Gage is no longer Gage. His mother wrote to relatives asking for help. And Marco says all that fits the pattern of traumatic brain injury.
Based on my own experience with people that have had similar types of injury, you can talk to them and they sound completely cogent. And then you talk to them another time and you're like, what planet are they on? And they can become extremely angry, but because they have these periods where they seem completely fine and normal, people really get angry with them and believe that they somehow or other they've got total control over the faculties when they don't. And this is the horror of traumatic brain injury. Some families just cannot handle a patient like that.
Harlow, on the other hand, was fascinated by the changes. There was a long-running debate at the time about whether different regions in the brain govern different behaviors. And here was a case of severe damage to the frontal lobe, followed by a dramatic personality shift. It seemed like a no-brainer.
And it laid the path where that you see the first real brain surgery done in 1885, the way that we think of it today. But it opened up a whole new horizon that you can sustain a brain injury, you can survive it, you can touch the brain, which means you can do surgery. It's huge. It's really, really huge.
Meanwhile, this new version of Phineas Gage had physically recovered. He was strong, still a young man, and he needed a job. For a while, he made money exhibiting himself around New England as a curiosity.
He would literally go in and you got to see the bar and you did that and he'd bend down and you could watch his brain pulse, sort of like watching a baby's, you know, before the fontanelles closed.
But he didn't want to be some sideshow freak. And then somehow he was offered a job as a long-distance stagecoach driver on the Valparaiso-Santiago route in Chile. It was a 100-mile route, 13 hours, handling a coach and six horses, plus passengers. The terrain was rough. There were revolutionaries in the hills. He did it for 7 years.
He was constantly surrounded by different languages because this is a protocol. You had an English speaking, you had Spanish, you had Portuguese, you had all these different languages, so he was hearing this. He had to memorize a route.
It doesn't sound like a job for a guy who was supposedly antisocial, volatile, incapable of focusing on anything for very long, and emotionally unpredictable. So how did he do it?
One of the things that we know that helps you hold on, because your brain is always sending you these new neurons, and today when we talk about neuroplasticity and how you use that to recorrect the pathways, or people talk about rewiring the brain, so you can see where just the lifestyle he had of constant new things are constantly giving him new experiences. So those new neurons as they're firing have something to stay around for.
In 1860, Phineas Gage began to have epileptic seizures. His health failed, and he went home to his mother. He died that May, 12 years after the iron rod entered his skull. Today, Phineas Gage's case is legendary. Entire books have been written about it. It's a staple of introductory classes in psychology, neuroscience, philosophy. But over the years, it's been interpreted differently. For a long time, people focused on, and maybe even exaggerated, his personality changes. There are stories that he lived rough in Chile, that he was a brawling, foul-mouthed drifter, that he drank himself to death. Today, he seems more like a model of rehabilitation and recovery.
Even well after the accident, after he had been healed, a lot of medical authorities just didn't believe it. It had to be verified.
It did, and of course, the final verification came from Harlow, who continually persevered and was able to obtain his skull, and he brought it back and held it up to the Mass Medical Society and said, "Here you go, folks."
Wait, this is his skull. So this was well after he died, then?
Yeah. Oh, no, they got that while he was alive. No.
Wow.
But after he died, Harlow never let this go.
And what about for you? What does this story mean to you?
I am fascinated what he overcame to survive for as long as he did. The resiliency piece of his story fascinates me, which is also a big part of the Solzhenitsyn story, is resiliency. I think it's just hardwired into our DNA, but you know, everybody right now is so worried about COVID and what the long term, or we're all going to be deranged humans. And well, you know, that's just not true. Humans in our DNA, we're wired to do some pretty horrific stuff, but we also are extraordinarily resilient, so I'm not worried about it.
Before we left, Marco showed us a photograph of Phineas. It's one of only two taken after the accident. You can see the scar on his cheek and the missing eye. But he's young, vital, handsome, well-dressed. Call it Portrait of Human Resilience. Thanks to Margot Caulfield, director of the Cavendish Historical Society in Cavendish, Vermont, for sharing his story.